first met Chris Stroup, I think it was a year and a half, 2 years ago, through the Exvangelical Facebook group, and then, of course, followed him on Twitter. And I've since discovered that he is becoming what they call a Twitter personality. At least that's how he was described in one of the articles that he's written. Chris is definitely identifying himself as an ex-evangelical. He is an ex-evangelical like myself and so many others who come out of evangelicalism, fundamentalism. And in this episode today, Chris and I are going to get into basically his backstory. What I was really interested in finding out about when I talked to Chris for this recording was, how did he get out of evangelicalism? What was his backstory? And we discovered that we have much in common. Both of us were raised in evangelical circles. We both went to Christian high school, and maybe it wasn't as funny for Chris as it was for myself and Jeff Judd. In fact, if you listen to the last 2 weeks, I met recently with a friend of mine, Jeff Judd, in Seattle, in the Seattle area when I was back there. And we shared some funny stories about what it was like when we were growing up in evangelicalism and in a Christian fundamentalist high school. But in Chris's case, he was more of an intellectual in the sense that he was having doubts and questions. And we're going to find out what happened when he had his crisis of faith. Did it get solved? Because what we find, and that's why I've titled this episode, Deconstructing Your Faith, A Long and Winding Road, because we're going to hear Chris's story. And we're going to find out how long it's taken him, and in fact, perhaps is still taking him, to disentangle himself from the evangelicalism and the fundamentalism, as well as the political aspects of this whole thing. Because, of course, as we know in America today, and it's historically been the case for probably the last, 80 to 100 years, the religious right, the fundamentalists, have increasingly grown in their power and in their political influence. And we're going to talk about that a little bit in next week's episode, part two. We're going to get into the history of the religious right and how that culminates in that 81%, the infamous 81% white evangelical voters who not only voted for Donald Trump, but continue to support him. And in fact, bizarrely, perhaps, or maybe not, in growing numbers, even no less, overlooking all of the moral failings. And I think it's very ironic, and I've said this many times before, that these are the same people who, when Bill Clinton was implicated in an affair with Monica Lewinsky, were screaming about the importance of family values and the importance of integrity in leadership and how this was so important. And yet these are the very same people who are overlooking all of Donald Trump's moral failings and yet are so concerned about preserving their religious freedom. So how did that party come into power? How did they get the influence that they do have even now in American politics, and indeed even in the rest of the world? Because, of course, so many evangelicals in America today see themselves as waging a culture war, and they desperately want to win this culture war. And this is something that Chris knows all too well, coming out of a background of sort of a young Republican slash Christian context. And he's traced in many of the articles that he's written in different journals about this issue of the global influence of American evangelical Christianity, what they have done historically in other parts of the world, and what they are doing. And of course, I've mentioned this as well in other podcasts. When I was teaching up in Leeds here in the United Kingdom, all of my students were from Africa. But what I found most interesting was, even though they came from places like Ethiopia, Eritrea, Zambia, Zimbabwe, places like that, almost every single one of them had this very fundamentalist, I would say, American, Western, conservative theology. And so it was obviously a result of them being indoctrinated, we could say, or coming to Christianity as a result of missionaries from the West, in most cases from America or here in Great Britain. So they've picked up this theology and they've come back to the West, as it were, bearing this sort of evangelical conservative theology. And it's very interesting to me, it was anyway, when I was teaching up there, how to interact with the people from Africa and me deconstructing my faith. I had to be careful what I said. I've had people question me in classes, and one lady, of course, asked me if I was even a Christian because I dared to question whether or not the Bible was the Word of God, or at least have them think about it. And she complained to the head of the school that one of the lecturers there, meaning me, was probably not a Christian. They should probably investigate me because I was a suspect at the very best. And so we see then the effects of global Christianity, certainly global American Christianity. And as I say, we're going to get into that next week a little bit more. But this week, as I say, we're going to talk about Chris's backstory. Really, I want to focus too on the emotional, the psychological trauma, the side effects of what it means to be raised within a Christian conservative context, and what happens when you have doubts, what happens when you have a crisis of faith. Because a lot of people, what they'll do is they'll try to get some help, and then a lot of times they'll double down and they'll go even farther. They'll dig in and say, okay, I have doubts, but it could be my fault. It could be my problem. So I'm going to double down. I'm going to dig in even deeper and defend Christianity even more and suppress my doubts, suppress my cognitive dissonance that I'm living with and I'm dealing with. But the truth is that a lot of people do end up, they say, I can't live with this cognitive dissonance anymore. I need to get out. I need to walk away. And thus begins or has begun that oftentimes very long and very windy road that has begun their deconstruction process. So maybe this describes you. Maybe as Chris and I are talking today, you'll identify with some or all of his backstory and maybe some of mine as well, because in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be bringing out an episode that me and my sister Valerie did. We recorded this the other day, and this is basically a one-year update of our story about surviving a fundamentalist upbringing that we did last year when she came to visit me here on the Rock. And I sat down with her and we went through another hour or so and we talked about what's changed in the last year. We get into a little bit of our backstories as well. What was it like to grow up in a fundamentalist Christian home, and what's that, what that's done to us in terms of, again, emotional, relational, psychological, sexual, all kinds of things in our marriages, in our dealings with other people. How has that affected us, and how is it still affecting us? Things that still trigger us, even though for both of us, we walked away from the church at least 8, 10, 12 years ago. So there's some interesting stuff coming your way after the two episodes with Chris Stroup. And then we've got two episodes with David Hayward, the Naked Pastor. And we get into, again, the same topic of what does it look like to deconstruct? How long does it take? What is the process? Is there a process? There's no formula, as we find out. And so look for those coming up. And then we've got two episodes with Cindy Wong Brandt. And that's another really great episode. She's coming to us from Taiwan, and she writes a lot about parenting and what the effects, again, on children are. And this is something that we talk about. How do you raise your kids as a parent and allow them the freedom, the autonomy to develop their own spirituality without being coerced or programmed or indoctrinated? And oftentimes, as we know, kids who are indoctrinated within not just Christianity, but any religion, really, when they go off and become adults, a lot of times they shed that faith because it's super shallow. It's not theirs. They never had ownership of it. And so we talk about some of those things with my conversation with Cindy Wong Brandt. So we got some great stuff coming your way. Also, remember, we're doing a live podcast on the 16th of September in the Seattle area. Me and Stacey Ray, she's coming all the way down from Canada, and I'm flying over across the pond to Seattle. So I'll be there for 6 weeks. So we're going to do this podcast episode on the 16th of September. And if you can't make it, as I've said before, send us your questions and we will discuss those with Stacy as well as with a live audience. And the best question will win a prize. So look for that. Also, I'm just going to say real quickly too, before we get into the conversation with Chris Stroup, part one, I'm going to be putting up a bonus episode on Patreon. For those who support this show, you can listen to a conversation that Chris and I had about 30 minutes or so, where we talk about, it's sort of a pre-interview conversation, and we start getting into some of the stuff that we're going to talk about. So if you want to listen into our pre-recording conversation, there's also one with Andrew Jasko, and I'm going to be doing that with other guests. I've got one coming up with David Hayward. Those will be available on Patreon for supporters of Mindshift Podcast, and the details for that, as well as the other contacts for me, social media and so forth, are always in the show notes. Probably the best way to get a hold of me is on Twitter at Mindshift2018, or you can follow me on a couple of other platforms like Instagram, Facebook, and so forth. So let's go on into it. I want to hear what you think of this episode too. Leave me your thoughts, your questions, your feedback when we get done with this conversation with Chris Stroup. So let's go on into it. Deconstruction of Your Faith, A Long and Winding Road with Chris Stroup, Part 1. I am joined today by Chris Stroup. Thank you for joining us on Mindshift Podcast, Chris.
Hi, Clint. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're coming to us from, is it Indiana? You've just moved, though. You've had a monster trip from what you were telling me earlier.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it went about as smoothly as you could expect for driving through, let's see, Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky, half of Florida, half of Indiana. So roughly five states with just one overnight. Wasn't too bad, but getting the apartment ready to move out of in Tampa and everything was pretty physically demanding. Got to pack stuff up, got to haul a lot of trash out. My dad drove down to Florida and helped me get ready to go, and so we could have two vehicles to drive more of my stuff up here, but I had to get rid of a lot of things too. So yeah, I've just been kind of, that was about a week and a half ago that we got here, trying to get more or less settled in. At this point, I'm focusing strictly on writing and speaking and public engagement as my professional activity, not going to be doing any teaching this academic year. After I graduated from Stanford in 2012 with my PhD, I got a job as a professor in a Russian university in Moscow, and I taught there from 2012 to 2015. I never intended to stay there permanently, but I also didn't know that things were going to go as south as they went. I mean, authoritarianism, creeping authoritarianism had been on the march in Russia under Putin and Medvedev, Putin in particular, but it really ramped up. And then, of course, with the annexation of Crimea, international relations changed a lot. Relations between Russia and the United States went downhill with falling oil prices and then the sanctions that followed the illegal annexation of Crimea. My ruble-denominated salary plummeted, and I was trying to deleverage from debt in dollars as much as I could at that time. So I then started looking even harder for jobs back in the United States. I was having no luck on the tenure-track job market, but I eventually got offered a provost postdoctoral scholarship in the humanities and social sciences at the University of South Florida. So I did that for 2 years in Tampa, and then I was able to get a visiting instructor position in the Honors College there at USF, and I did that for the last academic year. And then that train kind of ran out for me. I could have tried to stay there and just do adjunct teaching, but I ultimately decided that I was not going to let myself be exploited that way. You don't get benefits. The pay is pretty low. You know, I thought I'd just take the moment to try and focus on writing, public engagement, social media, building evangelical community. And I'm going to be doing that for that's all I'm going to be doing for the next 6 months or so. And then I'll continue to do that. But I do have an academic research gig with the Post-Secular Conflicts Project. It's an international interdisciplinary grant-funded project, multi-year, housed at the University of Innsbruck in Austria. So I'll be going there in the spring for a few months to do academic research. And then after that, I really don't know what I'm going to do, but I've taken this time to see where the writing and speaking and public engagement can bring me. And, you know, hopefully we'll really be able to do great things in the evangelical community going ahead.
So you've moved. This is what occasioned the move up from Tampa Bay. You're trying to kind of get your head straight a little bit and kind of refocused on sort of, I would say, not necessarily a new career path, but it's an extension of what you're doing, certainly in terms of social media. I mean, you're probably one of the more vocal people out there in terms of certainly on Twitter, as well as the Exvangelical Facebook group. You're one of the moderators on Exvangelical on Facebook. So you do a lot of stuff, and I think you're real passionate about evangelicalism, certainly not just in America, but sort of historically as well. This is something we definitely need to get into, I think, in this podcast, is what's your interest. But what's your backstory? I mean, did you come out of evangelicalism yourself? Or you consider yourself an Exvangelical?
Yeah, very much so. So let me say, first of all, I'm no longer a moderator of the Exvangelical Facebook group. I simply stepped down from that for sort of reasons of self-care and time. And yeah, I was definitely already in Florida doing more and more public engagement, writing things for popular audiences, publishing both commentary and journalism, also policy research with organizations like Political Research Associates, where I do look at what you might sort of call the global culture wars and the international networks involved in that, because conservative evangelicals, white evangelicals from America are heavily involved in networks in foreign countries, and these different kinds of international groups, organizations like the World Congress of Families, which is now associated with, under the leadership of Brian Brown, he took over from Alan Carlson, as the president of the World Congress of Families, he's put together this larger advocacy organization around it called the International Organization for the Family. This is basically a Russian-American project. They're the two biggest contributors to the World Congress of Families, and they always have been. And it, you know, came together in 1997. They started talking about it in 1995. So it's a post-Cold War thing. But yeah, the global authoritarian Christian movement to curtail the human rights of women, minorities, members of the LGBT community is out there and powerful, and American evangelicals are part of it. So my own story, I grew up in conservative evangelicalism, in the Christian right, mobilized for the culture wars. My family was never that invested in one particular denomination or doctrine. First, we were in a missionary church when I was a small kid, then a Baptist church, then a Wesleyan church. Then we ended up in an independent Christian church, which, of course, is itself a denomination that comes out of the Restoration Movement. And then we kind of went into the full-throated, megachurch-inspired, non-denominational movement, though technically under the aegis of the missionary church again. And what I learned from that was that it doesn't matter particularly if, say, I'm a Calvinist and you're an Arminian, or we may disagree about other fine points of theology. There are certain things that in the Bible are perhaps not all that clear after all, but what's very clear is that good Christians have to vote Republican, because we have to stop the gays, you know, and we have to ban abortion. So this is an example of what I call bad ecumenism. And there's an essay out there that I published about that, if anyone wants to find it. It's in a journal called The Wheel, which is actually, it's an Orthodox Christian journal published in the United States, not under the authority of any bishop or diocese, but by some very interesting and ecumenically minded Orthodox Christian intellectuals. They're the editors and the driving force behind this, and they're not beholden to priests and bishops. So they invited me to write for them, and I did. You know, just as someone who is a nun who comes out of Protestantism, who knows some things about Orthodoxy, and particularly about Russian Orthodoxy and its role in the global culture wars and the connections between Russia and the Christian right. And so they gave me a platform to write about that, which I appreciate.
So just out of curiosity, what exactly is your connection with Russia and Christianity?
Yeah, my own experience with Russia goes back to short-term mission trips that I did in 1999 and 2000. They were English camps organized by OMS International, a missionary organization based in Greenwood, Indiana. At that time, it was known only by its initials. Previously, it had been called Oriental Missionary Society, and even they understood that that was no longer going to fly, so they were just going by their initials. And they've since rebranded again as One Mission Society. If there's one thing you can say for evangelicals, at least those with more education and savvy in some respects, they're pretty slick at marketing and rebranding.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, in terms of your own deconstruction, though, what was it that sort of prompted you to question your evangelical conservative faith? You were talking earlier about you took some trips to Russia, but this was in the midst of kind of a crisis of faith of your own. What was it that occasioned your crisis of faith?
Yeah, it was a number of things. You know, I mean, I was able to read pretty widely in my childhood. I didn't have the kind of evangelical parents, despite my mom being a Christian school teacher and my dad being a music pastor, who were, you know, very invasive or micromanaging of my reading choices. And so I'd say, going back to earlier childhood, my grandma had gotten me a subscription to Ranger Rick magazine, for example, which had led me to think about environmentalism as an important thing and also taught me about evolution. And I didn't believe the evolution part at the time, but I was reading this secular literature for kids, you know. Also read a lot of secular novels and things, and kind of always knew the world was less narrow than the boxes that we were supposed to be staying in. I'm sure it was a source of some cognitive dissonance. But I was Christian school educated, heavily indoctrinated. However, Christian schools vary a lot. Some of them really don't provide you with any kind of decent education in any sense of the word, right? They don't teach you to write. They don't teach you to think. It's pure indoctrination. They're just telling you what to believe and basically to follow authority. But the one that I went to, while still very much a right-wing school, I mean, as juniors and seniors, we were even taken to far right-wing sort of Tea Party before the Tea Party political conventions in Indianapolis, there was this organization called Citizens Concerned for the Constitution. It's since rebranded as Advance America. You know, we were taken to their conventions, which were basically far right mobilizing kind of political events. Yeah. They were not neutral civics lessons, certainly. Yeah.
Young Republicans.
We got some God and Country stuff in the textbooks and in the classroom. We got Young Earth Creationism. But this school also had some AP classes, even before they had become so popular. So we're talking about the 1990s. I graduated in 1999. We had AP Biology, AP Chemistry. I think they already had, or no, maybe it came along a little bit later, AP U.S. History. I took AP English and AP Biology, got fives on both of those exams, but our AP Biology teacher was a kind of apocalyptic, mystic, right-wing weirdo who would often waste half the class time on rambling devotionals that he would call thoughts. They were often about the end times, you know, and he would go on and on, particularly at the beginning of the academic year, about how sin is increasing in the world, and he was particularly concerned about sexual sin and gay sin, of course, because they all are. You know, surely that means it's the year of Noah, and the Bible says as it was in the year of Noah, so will it be at the time of the coming of the Son of Man? And did you hear that they're genetically engineering red heifers to sacrifice on the Temple Mount and all this stuff? And
I've heard all that.
Conclude that Christ is probably coming back this year around Yom Kippur.
Yes, definitely. I can identify with that. I think many of us who grew up in evangelicalism or fundamentalism were told many, many times that Jesus is coming very soon. And this can actually be a very traumatic thing for a young person who's facing a pretty uncertain future.
Which really kind of scared me. Also caused some internal tension and turmoil because I, you know, wanted to have a chance to grow up and do things, and including things like having sex. And getting married would always come first in your mind, right? Because of purity culture.
Purity culture. You know. Oh, absolutely. I've done a lot of reading and research on the purity culture within evangelicalism. It's very pervasive and it's very damaging to young people who are told they must remain completely pure. And it's not just being a virgin, too. It's all about this black and white purity culture, isn't it? Staying pure and staying virginal until you're married. And that can cause a lot of psychological, emotional trauma as well as impact your sexuality, can it? I mean, imagine just trying to clamp down on your sexual urges. These kids just want to have sex. They want to get laid.
but also just to have a normal life, right? I didn't necessarily want the world to end right away. And then I would feel very guilty for thinking that. But anyway, when it came to AP Biology, that I had him for chemistry and for AP Biology, I didn't take AP Chemistry. He would not teach us the evolution chapters, and he did show us propaganda videos for things like Young Earth Creationism and flood geology, as well as normal nature documentaries. But he told us, you know, you go read those evolution chapters on your own and regurgitate them for the exam, but I'm not going to teach them.
I'm not going to have anything to do with that. Huh? I'm not going to promote that, all those Darwinian lies, huh?
He wanted us to learn it on our own and lie on the exam so that we would pass it. This school was a kind of strange mixture of, you know, rigor in its curriculum in some ways, and it likes to boast still of getting higher than normal SAT scores for the surrounding area. Of course, it charges tuition. The people there are disproportionately rich relative to the surrounding Indianapolis public schools.
Oh,
so that's
of course.
A big part of it, but
kids
they did teach us to formulate arguments, to write well, to identify logical fallacies. You were supposed to use all of it in the service of the culture wars and in the service of apologetics. But for some of us, you know, who took the idea seriously that we need to find the truth wherever it goes, you start to turn those tools around on the Bible, and you find yourself in a crisis, and that's partly what happened to me, and I think partly it was also just feeling like a lot of these politics and positions that good Christians, quote-unquote, had to take felt very inhumane to me.
Exactly right, Chris. You have identified a key problem within Christian education, and that is that if they're going to teach us critical thinking skills and critical academic skills, what happens when we turn those back on our own beliefs and look at the Bible and read it from a critical point of view?
Yeah, I read the entire Bible through for the first time at age 16, and I found certain contradictions. I wrote them down. I couldn't resolve them. So my crisis of faith kind of really started there. And I went and talked to our pastor at that time, who was then also, he became a Bible teacher in that school, and he lived in our neighborhood. So I went down to his house and talked to him about this. And at first he seemed very understanding with respect to my doubts. And he gave me a book of apologetics to read and come back and talk to him again. I don't remember what book it was. It was in question and answer format. And it wasn't one of the famous ones. It wasn't Josh McDowell.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But I read it, and I found the answers too glib. And I went back and still had doubts. And then all of a sudden, the problem was with me. I must be harboring sin in my life, opening myself up to demonic influences.
Yeah, how quickly it's spiritualized.
Because otherwise, if I were able to read the Bible through the Holy Spirit, I wouldn't have any problem now accepting it as absolute truth, accepting the Bible as inerrant.
Exactly. So it's a spiritual problem.
Right. So there, there was a time I thought I had committed the unpardonable sin, blasphemed the Holy Spirit, had a palpable lump of anxiety in my chest for about a week. I did some things as a result of that, like smash a CD with a hammer that I thought might be a vessel of demonic influence. It was Our Lady of Peace, by the way.
Wow. You went hardcore, man. You weren't smashing Black Sabbath.
I kind of tried. I really did not want to rock the boat. I'm an oldest child of two. I wanted to be a good kid always. I'm very sensitive, and I did not like conflict with my parents. And of course, you know, we're socialized in this environment to, avoid open conflict. So I couldn't push these doubts fully down, but I really, really tried, because I just did not want to face all the social costs that would come. And I thought I might go to hell. You know, I still, after I definitely gave up.
It's a very real fear.
One thing I will say for this pastor, I mean, his beliefs are awful and inhumane, but he does accept that annihilation might be a possibility, that it's a permissible interpretation of hell doctrine, which, you know, is a little bit more humane than eternal conscious torment. But I was still afraid that eternal conscious torment, which is mostly what I grew up with, might be real. And then later, after I stopped believing in any kind of hell, I still had this fear of it that would not go away. Over time, it would come back less and less, but it would still rear up sometimes.
Because what if you're wrong? That's the thing, isn't it? If you're wrong, we're all going to hell. That's pretty huge.
and they love to push that, you know, and it takes a while to be able to recognize that.
And I was raised with it, too. I mean, I remember going to see A Thief in the Night when I was a kid. You know, that movie, I don't know if they showed that when you were a kid, but back in the 70s, that was a huge evangelical scare tactic, that if you're not a true Christian, you're going to get left behind at the rapture, and then it's too late for you. There's no, God's kind of slammed the door shut, and you're done, you know? And I was terrified as a kid after watching A Thief in the Night, because I was convinced that I might not be a true Christian, and I was going to hell if I, in fact, missed the rapture when it happened. As you say, I was always being told that it was right around the corner. Jesus is coming soon. Jesus is coming soon. It's going to happen soon. So I'm terrified, thinking, my God, I'm going to be left behind, and I'm going to hell. You know, for a 12, 13-year-old boy, that's horrific in terms of your psyche and your emotional development, you know, like you say. Just unbelievable. So you're having this crisis of faith, too. And the stock answers aren't cutting it for you.
Right. You know, I've heard many stories like that, partly under the hashtag rapture anxiety, which I didn't coin. There were a few tweets with it from before when I used it, but I used it at one point, and it really blew up. And trended for a while, and a lot of people shared stories of growing up with fears surrounding the rapture and being left behind. And yes, I was definitely taught that Christ was coming soon, the rapture could happen. I had a little bit of fear of possibly being left behind.
Oh, yeah. It's not good news.
I mean, we were taught that, you know, if you were left behind, you weren't necessarily going to go to hell, but you had to avoid getting the mark of the beast. You could become a martyr in the tribulation by refusing the mark of the beast. But all that is still just really scary. I did not watch A Thief in the Night in my childhood until my senior year of high school. We watched it on our senior trip. Oh, get this. Heritage Christian School in Indianapolis, I don't know if it's still like this, but I think probably the senior trip was always to go to a Word of Life camp in upstate New York, Scroon Lake, New York, in winter. And you had to listen to two sermons a day. And they did show A Thief in the Night there.
Wow, that does not sound like fun at all. You're not really selling it here, Chris. Did you get to do anything fun? I mean, you had to hear two sermons a day and watch A Thief in the Night. That sounds like a drag to me.
Yes, we also, one day we got to go skiing. And we got to go look at the old Olympic Village in Lake Placid and to do some fun winter activities like ice skating and walking around Lake Placid. And we got to look at Niagara Falls. But two sermons a day,
they were pretty
much all about how everyone should be a missionary.
Oh, yeah. A lot of indoctrination.
Of course, we also had required chapel services.
Oh, of course.
As well, every week at the school. A lot of right-wing indoctrination as well. As just, yeah.
So mix some good Republican, yeah.
In those chapel services. But yeah, they showed A Thief in the Night, and I was a senior in high school, and the production quality is so bad, I thought it was kind of hilarious.
Oh, it's terrible.
At the time, even though I hadn't fully given up, you know, those kinds of beliefs, and they are scary beliefs, but the movie I just thought was funny. But I understand that when you're being shown it as 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old kid and told that this is going to happen soon, it could be absolutely terrifying.
Oh, absolutely.
And I've read many stories like that through the Rapture Anxiety hashtag.
Oh, yeah. The anxiety levels are unbelievable. I mean, I've shared this story before about coming home when I was probably 12, 13, and nobody was home. And I was utterly convinced that my family had been raptured and I'd been left behind. And, you know, I was turning on the news thinking this was going to be all over the news. And we didn't have a television, of course, because we were good fundamentalists. We weren't allowed to watch TV, so I couldn't go to the TV and watch the news. But I mean, I was freaking out, thinking I'd been left behind, and I was for sure I was going to hell. So yeah, you talk about rapture anxiety. So you had this crisis of faith. Anyway, you were the stock answers weren't good enough. So what happened then? You got out of evangelicalism. What was your journey out? How did you get out?
Really long, protracted, and painful. So, you know,
it always is,
I started to have these doubts in high school, but I went on that mission trip to Russia where in our English camp, we used English translations of the Bible as our readings for our tutoring lessons. So that was a pretty ham-handed way to proselytize people. And we also shared our testimonies, as you'd expect.
Of course.
I started to have some doubts about missionaries at that time as well, just seeing, you know, I didn't think they spoke the language as well as they should or claimed that they did, some of the ones that I was observing. And I also felt that it was really weird, despite the fact that the first year that I went on this mission trip, we did have some cooperation with local Russian Orthodox Christian structures, and a priest came to the camp and led prayer services. There was some controversy about that among the missionaries, though. Some of them didn't like that happened. And so the second year, 2000, we didn't have any connections with Orthodox structures. But yeah, I mean, we were basically trying to convert Christians to another form of Christianity, which felt super awkward to me. And by the second year, this was after my first year of college, I probably really shouldn't have gone back, but I was rationalizing it. I was telling myself, you know, maybe this will renew my faith. And I promised some of my friends that I made the first time I went to the camp that I would try to come back. So I went back and did it again. But my severe doubts continued. But I still just didn't want to rock the boat. And it was very hard to shape my programming. And I think that, you know, if I might have at that time had access to resources that are out there now, like the Exvangelical Facebook group, like my own blog, Not Your Mission Field, which is at ChrisTroop.com, and a lot of other great blogs and resources and Exvangelical Twitter, you know, if I had seen those things, they might have helped me feel less alone. And they might have helped me make progress with this faster. But I felt very isolated in all of it. And being an introvert, I'm not, and a Midwesterner, frankly, I'm not that inclined to reach out to people on my own. And so it takes some doing, you know, it takes me to have to muster up some energy for that sort of thing. And I'm a little bit shy about asking for help.
So you're suffering in silence in a way, not necessarily knowing where to go. It's tough, isn't it, when those resources aren't there and you don't know about them, or they just simply didn't exist back then. So what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of reaching out, do you find any help at all? So what was the end result of you getting out?
You know, I was doing a lot of reading, and I pretty much had in my head at that time that I wanted to be a college professor. Some of my professors in college as well helped me to think more about my doubts and just follow that path. I'm glad that I went to a secular college. Oddly enough, it's the one where my parents also went and met through their involvement with the campus house there through a Christian ministry. So they kind of had conversion experiences associated with college and really got into the hardline evangelicalism that I grew up with through college. I went to their same college for my undergraduate.
That has got to be the ultimate irony for sure. You go to the same college that your parents went to, but whereas they had a conversion experience and became evangelicals, you were in the process of deconstructing. That's pretty ironic, isn't it? So aside from the fact that your parents went to the same school, what was it that made you decide to end up at the same place they did?
And I got a full ride scholarship there, or I might have gone elsewhere. But it really was a good school to go to for the kinds of things that I wanted to study, except that I didn't know when I enrolled that I would want to study Russian. And they didn't have a Russian program anymore because a lot of those declined after the Cold War. But the honors college there was great. And some of the faculty became kind of mentors for me that I was able to talk to. And even if it didn't lead to radical transformation right away, it kind of did help me.
So you went to the same undergraduate college and it kind of helped in your deconstruction process. Where did you go after that?
I went then to study abroad for my third year. And I would say that was a moment where my deconstruction proceeded. And by the time I came back from studying abroad in Germany and England, I knew I couldn't call myself an evangelical anymore.
Now, I really hate to do it to you, but I'm going to leave you hanging right here. You got to come back next Friday to find out what happened in Chris's case when he came back and said to himself, I'm no longer going to identify as an evangelical. What was the reaction of his family, friends, and especially as he really came out of evangelicalism and made a kind of a bold statement? And we're going to find out what was that all about in next week's episode. So you got to come back for that. Now, I want to say, too, we're also going to get into tracing the history of American fundamentalism and how that relates to the religious right, as I was talking about in the introduction today, in terms of how they're influencing not just political things in America, but really all over the world. And these sort of global initiatives, seeing themselves as part of this culture war that they have to win. The stakes are incredibly high. So Chris is going to trace some of the backstory, the history of that, and how that relates to what we're seeing today. And I think this is kind of his platform now with his writing and the other projects that he's involved in, is really blowing the whistle on what's going on in evangelicalism, certainly in American evangelicalism today, and the pervasive effects of that. And he writes articles for Playboy magazine and in other places as well. So you can find those links as well by looking for Chris Stroup. You can find him on Twitter if you're one of the very few people, or certainly ex-evangelicals, who doesn't follow Chris on Twitter. You need to. You can find him there at @C_Stroup on Twitter, and that's probably the best way to get a hold of him. He's very active on Twitter, so if you don't follow Chris, you need to do that. You can also follow me, as mentioned before, at MindShift2018. You can find me on Twitter, and again, my social media connections are always in the show notes. And one last thing I wanted to mention too, for those who want to support this show on Patreon, there's some great bonus content that I'm putting up all the time. I'm doing this more and more now. One of the things is I'm going to be putting up a bonus conversation, this pre-recording conversation that Chris Stroup and I had. And in addition to those bonus conversations that I'm going to be bringing you, I'm also putting up new content that I've been recording. In fact, just the other day, I published a new bonus episode called My Journey of Deconstruction, and that is available on Patreon as well. And I tell my story and I get into some of the specifics of how I walked away, not just from the church, but ultimately Christianity itself, and put all some of the pieces together. So you can check that out if you want to support me on Patreon. There's one more thing I wanted to mention too, and that is I'm going to start putting up my podcast episodes a couple of days early, and these will be available on Patreon too. So if you want to catch an episode before it comes out on Friday, I'll be putting them up on Patreon probably Wednesday or so of the week. So if for supporters of this show, you can catch not only great bonus content, but have early access to podcast episodes also. And speaking of Patreon supporters, I want to give a shout out to James Snell. Thank you, James, for becoming the latest supporter of Mindshift Podcast on Patreon, and now he has access to all this great stuff, bonus content, bonus material that's only available for supporters on Patreon. All right, I'm going to let you go now. Be sure and come back next Friday. Check out the second half of my conversation with Chris Stroup as we get into a lot of other stuff on the intertwining of politics and religion in America and how that's affected so many people. So check back next Friday, and I will see you right here, along with Chris Stroup, as we continue deconstructing our faith on this long and winding road. I've been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. Thank you for joining me on Mindshift Podcast, and I'll see you next Friday.